agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you this morning?
Well, I hesitate to, I usually try to inject some kind of levity here, but I'm afraid I've got nothing this week.
It's not been a week for a lot of levity. Before we get to the reasons for that, we want to thank our newest supporters on Patreon, Jesse Whitman and David. Thank you so much, as well as Jeremy, who made a generous donation to the show through PayPal. And so, as you guys know, as a Patreon supporter, you get that second full-length episode every week that we now release at the same time as our regular available-to-all episode, and ad-free versions of everything, other stuff at various levels of support. To check it out, go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you would like to get that bonus show, but you're not in a position where you can afford to financially support the podcast right now, totally not a problem. Email me, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you set up with access to that. And also, as some of you know, we are on Venmo at politicsguys. So today we're going to be talking about Afghanistan, more on COVID, as you might expect, Missouri's Second Amendment Preservation Act, and maybe nullification, something we haven't talked about in a while, a progressive U.S. Senate candidate in Ohio, and what the whole midterm election landscape looks like for both parties in our view right now, and how the United States stacks up, I can speak, it is early, to other countries in a recently released report on national healthcare systems. So we definitely won't get to all that in the main show. And so a lot of that, and maybe even some listener questions, we'll be talking about on the bonus show. But before we get to that, we're just going to take a quick break and we will start things right off. Okay, Jay, so I think we will start with, I know we will start with the topic that dominated the news this week, Afghanistan.
Yes, and usually, as listeners know, we set this up where either Mike or I does a summary of what's happened and sort of gives a synopsis of the news that we're going to be talking about. And I'm not as good at that as Mike is. And unfortunately, there is a whole lot to try to compress. But I guess the short version, obviously, last week, the Taliban took control of Kabul, with the exception of the airport, which the United States still holds with 6,000 troops. The United States had issued a shelter-in-place order for Americans trying to get out at that time. There's been State Department guidance that has since come out saying, please try to make your way to the Kabul airport, but we cannot guarantee your security. President Joe Biden made a couple statements beginning on Tuesday. Then there was an interview with George Stephanopoulos, and then another press conference just yesterday. The increasing concern of mine, Mike, and you and I will talk about sort of the bigger picture nation building stuff too, but is it seems that what the president has said, compared with some of what his military advisors say regarding our capabilities to get people out, is really, to me, chilling, I guess. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin say that we just didn't have the capability to pull our people out individually, to go out outside the airport. To get them. Now, the French and the British and the Germans have been doing this. There was also a story yesterday that the United States did reach out outside the airport for several hundred yards via helicopter to bring in stranded Americans. All this while Joe Biden is saying that the Taliban have agreed to honor American free passage to the airport. Again, that seems to be at odds with some of the reporting on the ground or the fact that we sent a helicopter to pick up 169 people who apparently didn't have that free access. But Mike, this is, I will make this admission to you and to listeners. This has been something that's been deeply troubling to me, and something that I tend to pride myself on is that I don't get carried away or emotional over the news, or have responses that are again overly emotional. Right? I try to just be the pure analytical guy, for right or wrong. I know that sometimes puts people off sometimes, but this has been a tough week for me to keep my truly, you know, straight ahead and analytical hat on. So if I'm a bit scattered, that's part of it. I just wanted to say that going in. But so your thoughts, I guess, is the way we'll start there, as far as
sure.
You know, I guess the other piece I think I would turn to as maybe a good starting point. And there's plenty of blame to go around on this. And actually, I think listeners should, if they're interested, go back and listen to an April show that Mike and I did when President Biden first announced this withdrawal. And both of us came to the conclusion of, look, there's really no good options here. My option would have been to keep a presence there for some time for stability's sake, and yours was to get out. But I don't think either of us would have chosen the option or the situation where we are now, where we get out without setting up some sort of method, ability to get all of our people and our allies out. Yeah. And that's something that's frustrated me. Again, I'm sort of carrying on without turning it over to you. is sort of the Biden administration's, you know, well, no, I shouldn't say the Biden administration, let's just say Biden. His argument that, and this is something that, well, we couldn't have seen this coming. It was unforeseeable, but on the other hand, it's completely inevitable, and we factored this in. So with that, I guess I'll turn it over to you and get your impressions.
Sure. Well,
the biggest thing that was came across as shocking was that in that George Stephanopoulos interview, some of the things when Stephanopoulos asked him, is there anything that you could have done differently? Are you saying there were no mistakes? And Biden essentially said, no, this is what we expected.
On just one kind of, I don't know if it's a correction exactly, but for a while now, I've been actually saying that I thought we should keep a continual presence, small presence in Afghanistan. So just, you know, point, I'm sure listeners recall that.
All right.
But, and, you know, for actually quite a while now, but I guess my overall impression is this is the only way to really look at this, I think, fairly, is to say it's either a massive failure in intelligence, not knowing that, you know, the government could potentially collapse so rapidly, or a massive failure in planning and logistics, knowing that and not having a plan in place. And I think really maybe some of both. I don't have a problem seeing it as a double.
I hate to interrupt after my long preamble, but I would inject one other potential, is that a failure to act on the intelligence. If assuming there wasn't a failure of intelligence, the failure to act on.
Well, see, that's why I'd say there. That's a failure in planning. Then I would say.
Okay.
But yeah. So I, you know, I it's this is obviously a difficult situation. And I was very disappointed that President Biden didn't essentially own it. I think it would go a long way, at least with me, you know, for to hear the president say after something that's clearly a debacle, to say, hey, this was a debacle and the buck stops here and I take the blame for that. And there should have been a better plan in place, and we should have had this contingency for things falling apart this quickly. And he didn't really do that. And I think that is a significant failure in presidential leadership. And even though I agree with him, some of the things he said, like, you know, does anyone truly believe I would have not had to put in significantly more forces? So, yeah, maybe so. And, you know, he's made the case that this is sort of, I guess, a case of what you might call the sunk costs fallacy, right? Well, you stay because yeah. you and I think a reasonable case can be made for that. But what I don't think is reasonable is to say, well, you know, this was unforeseeable. Everything I did was fine. And it's always, to me, disappointing when something goes so clearly wrong and the person who has ultimate responsibility does not take that responsibility. So this is, to me, so far the blackest mark on the Biden presidency.
Yeah, I think we'd agree there. And something, again, that troubles me a lot is the I keep saying, you know, I went back and listened to our podcast from a couple months ago.
Don't do that.
It's like cringeworthy listening to yourself.
Yeah.
And there I did it again. But to me, the something that's frustrating is that Biden keeps reverting to the argument over, well, should we be there or should we not be there? And again, I think reasonable people can have that debate, but I don't think reasonable people can have the debate over if we're leaving, shouldn't we have a plan in place to deal with these contingencies? It's sort of like questioning the football coach of, look, you know, they have a botched punt and you know, they bobble the snap, the punter drops it. But the coach says, yeah, well, of course, but punting's the right choice.
Right.
No. That's we're not questioning the call, at least at this point, about whether you should have punted or whether you should have gone for it. The question is, wasn't this a botched play, even if it's a punt? And I feel guilty sort of making that analogy because it sort of trivializes what's going on. But I think it's frustrating, and you're seeing it even in the press coverage of, you know, George Stephanopoulos and some of the people who questioned President Biden yesterday on, you know, why didn't we see this coming? And there was also, you know, for example, again, it's drinking from the fire hose in terms of the news pieces here, but the State Department cable, the descending cable from the embassy staff in Kabul saying this is going to go bad very quickly. And the Biden response as of yesterday was, hey, look, we get lots of cables. I mean, that's unbelievable. From what I understand, this when a embassy staff sends what's called a dissenting cable, it's a pretty big deal. And again, there's this bizarre sort of Biden refusal saying, well, no, the intelligence never told me that this could happen, or, well, there wasn't consensus that this could happen. Again, listening back to our podcast back in April, Mike, there was consensus between you and I that this would happen. and again, we're two guys doing a Saturday morning podcast without any specific intel information, but we read the newspaper, and you don't need a weatherman to tell which way the wind blows. And your statement was that the Afghan government was pretty unlikely to stand up against the Taliban. I tried to find the place. I thought I had predicted at some point that the Afghan government would fall before the end of the summer. And that might have been an earlier podcast when we talked about the initial Trump proposal. But regardless. It's something, the idea that this could happen very quickly. Isn't something that was so outlandish, or that you wouldn't think you'd have some sort of plan for it.
I mean, I don't want to beat this dead horse completely into the ground. So I think it's clear that we agree. I think in general a consensus view might be that, well, Joe Biden wanted to get out quickly for largely political symbolic reasons, I think, you know, before the 9/11 anniversary, that sort of thing, and he put, in my view, and I think a lot of people's views, the politics of that ahead of the actual operational realities, and kind of crossed his fingers and hoped that it wouldn't go as bad as some intelligence that he clearly had would indicate. And it went sideways. And now he's trying to pretend that that wasn't the case in the first place. I think that's kind of what we agree on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
So
absolutely.
Moving forward from that, there are at least a couple of issues. I think one is, what's going to happen with the Taliban? Right. Because as you mentioned in the intro, the Taliban say that they're going to respect women's rights and not do all this kind of stuff. Well, not basically and not be the Taliban. And already we see at least some Taliban leaders, fighters going against that. And I got to say, it's important not to say, well, there's this one incident that shows that this is what the Taliban are going to do, because it's not like they're the Borg or something like that. But that said, given those incidents,
look, Mike, if you're going to hold a few bad apples, if the entire Taliban responsible for the activities,
this is the argument that the right makes about policing all the time, right? And what I'm saying is that we shouldn't point to one case and say, well, this is how it's going to be. But given those cases we've seen so far, plus what we know about the Taliban as a group, it seems incredibly unlikely that they will respect women's rights, that they will be some kind of bastion of freedom, that they will forgive their enemies, and that they will basically be very strict about having terrorists set up shop in their Afghanistan. I think all of those things are almost certainly untrue, and I expect you agree with me about that.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and so the other, I don't know if we're going to disagree about this, but there's also the refugee crisis issue, you know, and I think there's an interesting split in the Republican Party on this. For instance, Tucker Carlson, the most powerful Republican conservative, whatever you want to call him, populist whack job commentator out there, said early this week, if history is any guide, and it's always a guide, we will see many refugees from Afghanistan resettle in our country in coming months, probably in your neighborhood. And over the next decade, that number may swell to the millions. So first we invade, and then we're invaded. It's always the same. That's Tucker Carlson. And then you have Mitch McConnell says, well, we need to care for them. We owe it to these people who are our friends and who work with us to get them out safely if we can. So, I mean, to me, Jay, that pretty clearly illustrates a split in two elements of the current Republican Party. And I wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah, well, obviously, I'm in the Mitch McConnell camp. Mm-hmm. I would welcome these people to my neighborhood. I would celebrate them if we had people. I think we probably already do where I live. Actually, we have a fairly large Middle Eastern immigrant population, many refugees. I know some from Iraq. I don't know particularly if we have, I don't know anyone personally, refugees from Afghanistan in my community, but I do know some Iraqi refugees. I would be proud to welcome them in that they have exemplified America more than most Americans will ever have the opportunity to do, right? I mean, really, really put their lives on the line for our values. So I am very much in the McConnell camp, first of all, for the moral and humanitarian reasons that we owe it to these people. If I'm thinking in my purely Kissingerian analytical piece, we owe it to them. And this is what I said on the April episode, because it's a piece of how we project soft power in the world. And if we expect people to help us, we need to keep commitments to them. And abandoning people certainly eliminates or makes our ability to do business in other places of the world much, much more difficult if people can't count on us to protect them if things go bad. So I am of the, you know, I'm to the point of like, look, anybody at the airport, let's get them on a plane and get them out of there. And if you want to sort out the paperwork later, we can do that.
Yeah, I'm encouraged that the Pentagon announced this week that they, you know, they intend to settle over 20,000 asylum seekers who helped us out during the war, and also that governors from 11 states, and I should point out that 6 Republican and 5 Democratic states, I believe, said they'd be willing to take in refugees. So I think that's an encouraging sign, despite what, you know, Greg Abbott might want to do in Texas there.
I'm saying this in pretty serious. I haven't checked it with my wife yet, but I mean, I'd have people stay in my house. I mean, that's
There you
go. That's how strongly I feel about this. I guess the frustration is, so the military and the State Department says, yes, we're going to approve these, process these people. But the big assumption is assuming they can get to the airport, assuming they can get out.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wanted to ask you about another kind of related thing. I mean, I was encouraged also by the fact that the Speaker Pelosi said that the House Foreign Affairs Committee will hold a hearing on the situation. I think actually as early as next week, they want to start doing that. And I've been encouraged by what I feel is a fair amount of bipartisan agreement that this was a horrible thing. This was badly handled, and that we need to do everything we reasonably can for our allies. And so I think this was obviously a tragic event, but I see a lot of positive things in the aftermath. And so I'm encouraged by that.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. I'm encouraged by the bipartisan response in Congress. And something though that, I mean, I think we do need to talk about, and this is what's really been troubling me, is the fate of Americans who are still in Afghanistan. Because I don't believe the administration has been forthcoming on that and how this is going to work. I mean, there was, again, President Biden has said, well, as far as he knows, the Afghans are letting Americans through all the checkpoints. There's evidence on the ground to the contrary. The State Department still doesn't really have a count of how many Americans are in the country. I've heard, you know, well, a few thousand to 10,000 to 15,000. And there are these statements that, you know, in the press conference yesterday, you know, President Biden said, well, we're going to do everything. Everything's on the table to get all Americans out. And someone says, well, okay, how about we go out and pick them up? And like, well, no, not that. That's not on the table. You know, the Taliban's still, you know, the airport's secure and the Taliban's agreed to let them through. That is really.
But I guess I wonder what you would have any president say, given the fact that the situation seems to be so fluid and even chaotic. I feel like it's difficult to say anything definitive except we're going to do everything we can to get all Americans out. And so that to me is really the only response you can make given how the situation.
Well, right. I mean, but that's exactly the thing. You say we're going to do everything we can. And then there's the question, well, okay, how about we go out and pick them up? Well, and then there's also the rather ominous verbiage that this appeared from the Pentagon and also in Biden's statements yesterday about every American who wants to leave will be able to be evacuated.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine there are Americans who'd want to stay, but
right. But what's so ominous about that qualifier?
I guess because there may be Americans who want to stay for God knows what reasons, and we're not going to forcibly evacuate people. I think that
as a defender of freedom,
I would think you'd like that.
The qualifier is an admission that we know we're not going to be able to get all the Americans out.
I don't understand. See, okay, I think here there might be a double standard, and I just want to push back a little bit, because under the previous occupant, I do not recall you honestly subjecting statements, presidential administrations, to such incredibly fine textual analysis. I mean, it seems to me like you're trying to find something in the tea leaves here, and I don't think
that's really consistent. Right? I mean, given that the administration can't or won't tell us how many Americans are still in the country, they can't or won't tell us how many Americans have been evacuated already, or the percentage of Americans who are leaving on these other flights. They can't or won't confirm that all Americans are actually getting through the checkpoints.
I don't know how this is ominous to you.
Then we're sort of left with reading tea leaves.
I mean, I don't know how this is ominous.
It just seems really odd that you include that phrase of who want to leave will be able to. Why do you say that? Why not say we're getting every American out, no matter what? Are you going to stay? Will you stay past August 31st to do that? Well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But yeah, absolutely, all options are on the table.
I agree with you about the incompetence, but I think you're building this up into, I mean, yeah, what's it, the phrase from, attributed, I think, incorrectly to Napoleon, never ascribe to malice that which can be explained by incompetence. And I think this was, you know, just an incompetent political response, but the idea that there is some sort of deeper, darker sort of ominous thing going on here, I just think that's reading well beyond anything that is there. And again, I think... Go ahead.
Well, let me ask it this way. Do you think the Taliban will continue, assuming it is, continue to honor letting all Americans through all the checkpoints?
I don't think all Taliban have honored that, you know, because they're not the Borg. And so it's not like they're all on a text chain and the message goes out to everyone. You know, I mean,
they're on Twitter.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
they use Twitter. Again, the Taliban is not banned from Twitter, but President Trump is, but that's another story. But yeah, let's assume that some Taliban are not arguing this or not honoring this. What do we do if you're the president?
Well, I mean, you know, and I think that's the case where you say, well, what's a proportionate response? And do you say, well, you know what, we're going to send in, if we have to send in 100,000 troops and reduce the country to glass with a campaign of nuclear bombs to get out every American, well, God damn it, we'll do that. I mean, no, there are lines, right? No, of course not. That's ridiculous.
Look, if I'm the president, this is what troubles me immensely. Because this is beyond simply, you know, Biden in his speech yesterday said, you know, asked, hey, what's America's interest in Afghanistan anymore? Well, our interest at this point is getting our people out and our allies out.
But again, he was doing, making the error that you're talking about. I don't want to conflate these two things.
Exactly,
he was talking about the wisdom of getting out as opposed to not owning the failure of planning and leadership in actually executing orderly withdrawal.
Right.
Two different
but
things.
Now we, let's put it this way. Setting all that aside, there is plainly a U.S. interest, perhaps the most paramount interest, foreign policy interest ever, of getting our people out
sure.
who are trapped behind hostile foreign lines. And I guess it's disappointing that the response is, well, we're talking to the Taliban every day. And to me, this is, like I said, I'm maybe a little off my meds this morning or something. I would take a much more bellicose stance. I would say to the Taliban, listen, every single American is getting through these checkpoints. If there is much as a red light that these guys have to wait at, we're going to level every government building in Kabul.
Yeah, here's the problem with that, Jay.
If any harm comes to any American, and again, this was the bizarre sort of stuff that came out that he's saying, well, if any harm comes to any American troops, if you fire on any American troops, there's going to be reprisals.
See, and I so disagree with that, because that's the sort of language that escalates things and leads to more people being killed. Because as I said, there can be a random incident, and once you set up a red line and you either, you know, and you don't honor what you said you were going to do, that's, I mean, we talked about that with Obama.
I'm for.
But the idea that if any, say, random Taliban fighter fires on an American, say, well, we're going to level every building, but we're not savages. I hesitate to use the word savage, but I know that that's not what Americans do. Americans don't say, hey, you know, for every one of ours that you hurt, we're going to kill 100 of yours. That's not who we are. That's not what we do. And if that is, that has become who we are, we've lost something just incredibly important.
Well, I would say in defense of our own citizens who are trapped in a hostile country, that's acceptable.
Saying that is
who we are.
Let me be clear. It is
defensible morally and I think legally defensible.
Terrorism.
To say
terrorism is defensible because saying that we will level your city and all these innocent people in the city if you do not do this thing that we want you to do, do not let our, that's terrorism. We are not terrorists. Americans are not terrorists. And if we are, then we've lost what it means to be Americans.
Well, if we abandon American citizens, the Taliban, haven't we lost what it means to be American?
I'm not saying we do that. I'm saying we do everything we can ethically and morally, within ethical and moral bounds, to get every American out. Absolutely, we should do that.
And you don't think that includes threats of force?
I don't think that.
And carrying out those threats of force.
I don't think that includes carrying out threats of force against innocent civilians. No, I don't. I don't think we harm innocent people to advance our interests, or I think that's a morally repugnant thing.
I think you and I have a different view of the world.
Wait. Before our different views of the world.
No, I'm certainly saying we don't target innocent civilians. That's why I say we every government building.
But who works in government buildings? I mean, they're all running around with AKs and trying to kill
Taliban
America.
Now.
Yeah, and the idea that there are not going to be, civilian non-combatant casualties is just, and so again, it's a matter of proportion.
I think we make this quite plain, as we've done this sort of thing in the past. This is what we're going to destroy this. Oh, I mean, we could also say, listen, we're going to destroy every U.S. aircraft we can find in Afghanistan. I think that's something we ought to do anyway.
Yeah, I understand that logic. Yeah,
but the idea that we're just going to count hope the Taliban lets our people out. And again,
I don't think it's as black as white.
Consider what we went through in Iran. There was 52 hostages for 444 days. We're looking at the potential of thousands of hostages.
Yeah,
indefinitely.
Absolutely.
Who might be summarily executed.
But I think you're getting
and
ahead of yourself.
Like, well, we're talking to the Taliban and go outside the airport. Well, we've sort of agreed not to do that.
I think you're filtering administration statements through a lens that is very much inclined to assume weakness and capitulation on the part of Democrats, and that's definitely coloring your view on that.
It is. Yeah. That's my lens.
Yeah, and I
think it's accurate.
Yeah, and obviously I would disagree on that. So let's move on to one other issue related to this, I think, and that's the Taliban government, because there's a question of how to deal with this new government. The common sort of thing you do is you freeze assets, which we've done. You cut off access to the international banking system, foreign aid, foreign capital investment, that sort of thing. And the problem with that, obviously, is it's a kind of a perennial problem, is how do you punish elites without hurting the people, right? Because, for instance, the Afghan government is the country's largest employer. And, of course, those people are not going to be getting their paychecks at the end of this month. And it's, you can't do, as you said, you can't do nothing, but trying to figure out how to sort of best move forward. And once we get all Americans out, I should point out, that would be my priority as well. That's going to be a difficult question.
That's not a question that's I'm concerned about whatsoever.
I guess I'm wondering, do you care at all about
bellicose and say I don't give a rat's ass whether employees of the Afghan government get paid.
So that's okay.
I mean it, this
that,
this is sort
feel,
of the idea.
Feel,
well,
sure.
we have no interest there. There's no national interest. There's no but we're going to be concerned now about. What if the government's unstable because they don't have enough foreign aid?
Well, I mean,
it's already fallen. It's already fallen to the Taliban, to savages.
But isn't that a reasonable
position? Is we're out, then we're out.
So we're out, and the hell with them. Let's just isolate them and let the country burn down. I mean,
look, my position, as I made clear, and what you said, earlier, was you would have stayed. At least in some respect, kept some sort of force on the ground to either assist with this type of thing of pulling people out if we had to, or just providing some sort of leverage to allow the old Afghan government to try to find its footing or come up with some sort of political solution with the Taliban, which I don't think would have happened. I think the Taliban just would have waited out and eventually would have taken the country militarily, because that's what they do. But yeah, if the idea is we're out, then okay, I'm not going to worry about foreign aid or anything else. And this, again, I'm sort of, you know, proud neocon on this kind of thing, right? I said back in that other show that the problem that what 9/11 pointed out to us is there aren't really any corners of the world that don't matter to us. And sooner or later, it will come to our doorstep. So if the argument is that an unstable Afghanistan is going to be a bastion for terrorism, yeah, I agree. Is it going to cause a refugee crisis in Europe? Yeah, absolutely. Is it going to destabilize the region even further? Sure. Is it going to provide leverage for the Chinese or Russians? Probably. But, you know, all that goes to the bigger Biden picture, which at this point, I think that decision, that ship sailed. So I guess I don't get the idea of, okay, we're going to get out of here, but we'll still provide some sort of monetary aid now to the Taliban government.
I don't know. I'm not suggesting that necessarily. I'm saying that just in a larger sense, this is not something you can just put your head in the sand and not think about. Because, of course, when you have failed states, when you have massive economic upheaval, more people are likely to become, I think, other things being equal, radicalized, and it creates an environment that maybe makes it easier for those sort of things to happen. And so we can't just simply say, well, we're in or we're out, because there are countries in the world and are just pretending that they don't exist. That's not a response. They're going to exist and things are going to happen within those countries, whether we want that or not. And so we can't just avoid the question of, well, how do we deal with the Taliban government? We have to deal with them in some way. And that's just a fact. That's just a matter of fact.
I'm not sure what, when you say deal with the Taliban government, what exactly do you mean? I mean, are you talking about providing foreign aid to them, or unfreezing the assets, or,
well,
or,
I'm,
or
I'm,
what?
I'm saying not necessarily. The problem is making sure, or trying to ensure that the entire, you know, that you don't have the sort of failed state conditions that create, you know, humanitarian, well, greater humanitarian crisis and then potential security concerns for the U.S. with terrorism and that sort of thing, and by a completely draconian stance that just destroys a country that's already more than teetering on the brink. I'm not saying that there's an easy answer that I know how we should deal with this Taliban government. I think that the approach to this point has been a good one, saying basically that, well, you know, a lot's going to depend on what they give us. And so I think it's, you know, kind of both ways here, that, you know, the Taliban certainly does not want to be more or less cut out of the international system, aside from, I'm sure, the help they will get from Russia and China, at least on the sly. And yeah. So they have some interest here. And so that's real politics, right? You work with whatever leverage that you have, and turning your back entirely means that there's no leverage at all. And that can be a dangerous thing. That's all I'm saying. I'm not suggesting specific proposals here.
Mike, if we can't get our people out, if our military is either unable or prohibited by some agreement to leave the Air Force base, we've already lost. We don't have any influence.
I'm not arguing.
Idea that we ought to somehow give them money or make it easier for them to get through these rough times. Let's let the humanitarians in Russia and China spend money on this then.
It's interesting to me, because I feel like on this story, more than really, I think almost anything else I can recall us talking about it, It's really striking to me, the emotion I hear from you. And again, in a way,
But
what's interesting to me is that, and I'm sorry, but I can't help comparing that to January 6th. And I feel like you're a lot more upset by that than you were by this. And you know, you're going to have whatever reactions you're going to have. But I don't know. That's just, it's just really, I, I,
Oh, I am much more upset about this than I was about January 6th.
Wow. Okay.
January 6th was a bunch of imbeciles who took it upon themselves to think they could stop an election, and they couldn't, and they rioted, and they broke a lot of stuff, and they hurt a lot of people. The FBI actually just released a report saying that they believe there was no sort of really concerted effort or a plan that went into this. It was just sort of a spontaneous riot and people doing this. This, on the other hand, is potentially the United States government turning its back on thousands of its own citizens and leaving them in what may be the worst place in the world.
Let me be clear, Jay.
So to me, that's why it's different. One is there's a group of rioters, and who do not represent the United States government. They were taken out and put down, and they're being prosecuted right now. The other is the U.S. government, whether by negligence or at this point some sort of design or some sort of cutting their losses, seems willing to abandon its own citizens.
And you're making stop right there. You're making an assumption, and it's an unfair assumption, and you're wrong. The idea that anything that Joe Biden or the administration has said is saying that they are willing to abandon American citizens, that's just wrong. And maybe we'll look at this 3 months from now, 6 months from now, and you'll be able to look back and say, see, I told you we were going to abandon citizens and that. But that's a very different thing from what happened on January 6th, and not just the rioters, but the aftermath, where a majority of Republicans, at least in the House, a large number of Republicans, at least in the House, decided to turn their back on, or were willing to turn their back on, what millions of American voters asked for, and subvert the electoral process for political gain. And so I guess that's why we see January 6th very differently. And so while we are both disgusted by what happened here, I actually, when you said you were much more concerned about this than January 6th, I sort of had to just stop and sort of take a breath, because I was just so just stunned and taken aback by that. And I think it really goes to how differently we tend to view these things.
Yeah. To me, the fundamental purpose of the American government, especially when we're talking about foreign affairs, is to maintain the safety of American citizens.
Sure, I would agree. Absolutely.
And I'm concerned that at this point, our own State Department has advised people that they said, let's try to get to the airport. We can't guarantee your safety. Good luck. Other countries are going out, actually into Kabul and other places, getting their people and bringing them to the airport. And for some reason, we are not. And that is inexplicable, and I haven't heard a good reason out of the United States government why we're not doing that. And to me, that is tantamount to, abandoning people. And, Biden says we don't want to be in Afghanistan forever. There may well be some Americans who will be in Afghanistan for forever, or however long they last after we're all gone. And I think this is an alarm. This is Tehran times, hundreds, thousands.
Well, it could be. You don't know that.
It could be.
It's important to point that out, Jay, because right now, we don't, as you point out, we have no special information. Right now, I think you would agree, this is an incredibly fluid, chaotic situation. And so it certainly could be the case that this is the sort of thing that we're able to work out some sort of arrangement, and that actually all the Americans who want to leave do in fact get out. That could happen. So
I very much hope so.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying this is not Tehran right now. Now, we could look back in a few months and say, well, it's pretty clear that the Taliban is essentially holding thousands of Americans in effect hostage in exchange for X, Y, or Z. I'm not saying that that's not possible. I agree with you that it is possible. All I'm saying is that is not what is the case right now. That's all.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Fair enough.
All right. Well, why don't we, we've been on this for a while, as you expected we would be, and you were right about that. But why don't we take a quick break and then come back and move on to what's going on with COVID? Okay, Jay. So, that was a very emotional segment. Definitely, I think we got into it a little bit more than we have in a while. A lot of things, but as you said, yeah, that was to be expected. You put the trigger warning in there for us at the beginning.
Yeah, I did.
So.
I did.
Let's move on to talk about, unfortunately, what's a perennial topic for us, and that's COVID.
Yeah. So on the COVID front, President Biden made an appearance to say that the FDA, CDC will now be recommending booster shots for anyone 8 months after they've had their initial doses of either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines. So for a lot of people, that could be starting up in early fall. Related to that, the Biden administration is also threatening to pursue civil rights litigation against these number of states that have incorporated anti-mask mandates for schools. Texas, I think, being one of them, Florida being another, threatening that essentially the school board members would not be able to get paid, albeit most school board members don't get paid much, absent their agreement that or if they complied with the state bans,
right,
in absence of a federal ban. This is also coming on the heels of. I would say vaccinations seem to be trending up still, but there are also concerns of these people who have been the breakthrough infections, people who have been vaccinated but yet still contract the virus. So that's sort of our state there. And again, I apologize, I'm still sort of scattered over Afghanistan, but.
I gotta say,
so what are your thoughts first, on that? On the booster shot, the other piece I neglected to announce is it's anticipated that the FDA will give full approval, non-emergency use approval to the Pfizer vaccine early next week.
Yeah, well, first off, which will change
change the game a little bit in terms of whether those vaccines can be required.
Yeah. You know, I first off almost feel like I should apologize to you, because it seems like the last couple of times you've been the one doing the story intros, we've had these big sprawling sort of things. First Afghanistan and all the stuff with COVID, and it is just random chance. But I felt bad.
I'm not terribly.
But so, you know, on this, I should point out that I am concerned, and I think a lot of people are concerned, because the data I look at, you know, new cases, that's obviously concerning. But I look at hospitalizations particularly, and from what I can see right now, they are actually the highest they've been since early February, and trending upward, which is, you know, pretty bad. And we've talked a lot about Florida, for instance. I mean, on Friday, it was the Florida State Board of Education sent the order to Broward and I believe Alachua County, saying that they have to come. 48 hours to comply with this opt-out option for masks. And then also on Friday, the Sarasota County School officials voted to defy the no mask mandate thing. And I think I focus on Florida because, of course, Florida is the epicenter of this. One, I believe it's just about one out of every five hospitalizations for COVID is coming out of Florida. And, that's really a big deal when you take a look at hospitalizations. It's Florida and then everyone else by quite a lot. And so that to me is the big concern. And there are concerns in other districts and other states, but Florida, I think, really exemplifies it, especially with students starting to go back to schools. And I wanted to get your take on this, because last week, you know, I talked to Kristen and I did the show, and she, I think, surprised, maybe not surprised, but a lot of viewers had a lot to say about her grading Governor DeSantis at a B with his response to this. And I wanted to get your take on the Florida situation, because I think it's kind of a good sort of microcosm in a way of what we see in a lot of places, especially a lot of red states, with certain exceptions, like, say, Louisiana. So what's your thinking on that?
Well, when we talked about this a couple weeks ago, I took my, as you might expect, kind of local control piece. And that's where I still am. I'm not crazy about a state telling school districts how they have to run their school district. I think let's let that up to the school district and let parents go and show up at the school board meeting and yell and scream and let democracy work that way. Right. I'm against sort of a state mandate, whether it's no masks or whether it is masks, because different school districts are going to be different. And parent tolerances are going to be different and vaccination rates are going to be different. So that said, I'm not a fan of DeSantis's approach, but nor am I a fan of sort of the federal approach then to, you know, it's squash a state and saying this is a civil rights case. I don't see that as a civil rights case. On the hospitalizations, I'm looking for the numbers right now in terms of how many of those are hospitalized were unvaccinated, because I think that's significant. I know that is a significant number that, you know, of people who are vaccinated, your risk of being hospitalized, first of all, your risk of contracting it in the first place is significantly lower. Even in a breakthrough infection, those are pretty rare. And your risk of being hospitalized through a breakthrough infection is even rarer. And I apologize for not having the numbers in front of me.
I don't have the hospitalized or vaccinated, non-vaccinated, hospitalized, but looking at the, you know, hospitalized per 100,000, Florida's at 77 and number two, Louisiana's at 58. And Florida's overall vaccination rate right now, fully vaccinated, is 51%, which is actually the highest of all the states that have these really high per capita hospitalization rates, like Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia. They all have well under 50% vaccination rates. Florida is, you know, up there, but they're getting a lot of, obviously, a lot of.
Well, Florida could also, you would expect probably the higher hospitalization rates just because of the demographics, right? Of those people who are exposed, you're more likely to have more people who are older.
Maybe so. Yeah, maybe so. So
yeah, so well, I think you could probably, you know, figure that in, that there may be more people who vaccinated or unvaccinated. Even if you have a breakthrough infection and you're in your 80s, you're probably more likely to be hospitalized than if you have a breakthrough infection in your 40.
Well, let me ask you this. So it seems to me politically that the governor can't, I mean, he's sort of in a position where he's gone too far out on this limb. And it would be very difficult for him to kind of pull back on the no mask mandate.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it also seems to me that there have been cases like in Louisiana and some other places, I think it was Arkansas, wasn't it, where governors have sort of backtracked in light of just a flood of COVID cases that overwhelmed their system and have caused pain, suffering, and death to a pretty significant degree. And I'm wondering, especially with, you know, school starting and pediatric COVID cases quite on the rise and, you know, kids under 12 not being able to get vaccinated, if you think there would be a point in Florida at which the governor would have to sort of back off, or do you just think it just does not matter, that it's just going to ride this all the way through?
I think he'll ride it out.
Yeah. Despite how many people get COVID.
Well, I mean, I think you won. I mean, you can make the argument that most of the people who are getting COVID are the unvaccinated, and go get your vaccine, right? That's one argument. And from sort of a conservative libertarian standpoint, at some point, you reach a certain number of look, people just aren't going to do this, and it, you know, they have to make their own choices and live with their own consequences. And that sounds cold and heartless and so forth. But I mean, this, there's been so much made of trying to encourage people to get vaccinated, right? I mean, we're giving them money, we're entering lotteries, we're trying to scare them to death, we're doing all these things. And And you're going to reach a point where there are some people who just won't. And there's probably a small percentage of the population that can't, right? I don't know what those numbers are, but I think there's in any vaccine regime, there's probably some immunocompromised people who
sure,
you know, actually can't get vaccinated. But that's a fairly small number when you're talking about the overall public. But you get to that point, and you know, I think numbers have gone up for vaccinations in the South since they've seen these big spreads, and they're saying, yeah, this is really happening. Now that there's the FDA approval, that's going to add a little more. I don't think it's going to change the mind of someone who says, no, I'm not going to get the vaccine just because I don't believe in it, I don't trust in it, or whatever. But it's going to help on the margin.
Yeah, I think, right? So.
It's going to take away the argument of, you're telling me to get this vaccine, but you still won't actually officially say that it's safe.
But I think
that happens. But otherwise, I think we end up with a situation where you're going to have a lot of unvaccinated people who will get it, and they'll kind of vaccinate themselves that way.
The problem to me, and I think we shouldn't completely downplay breakthrough infection thing. For instance, just looking at one area, Los Angeles, people who were fully vaccinated in April, they were 5% of those people were hospitalized for COVID, 5% of all the COVID hospitalizations. Right. So 95% weren't. But by July, that number had gone up to 13%. So it's not like this is, if you get COVID and you're vaccinated, you know, well, you're going to be, it's just going to be like a mild case of the flu. I mean, there are a large and increasing number of a non-insignificant number of people who have cases serious enough, even though they're vaccinated, that they have to go to the hospital. Maybe they have underlying health issues. There's a lot of that in this country, certainly. But so that's why I think it's more than just a person. If it weren't for the Delta variant and what we're seeing, I think there would be a stronger argument. But it seems to me that from what we're seeing, that this is it's incomplete to put this simply in personal liberty sort of in that sort of framework alone, because it seems pretty clear that this is not just a personal liberty issue.
Well, I think that's going to change a little bit with the introduction of the booster shots, though. Right.
That
I mean,
the idea
of the booster shots is that's going to, you know, part of the problem with the breakthrough infections is that the immunity wanes over time. Yeah. You get your booster shot, that knocks you back up to, the higher immunity, and you're much less likely to get a breakthrough infection or have it be serious. As much as the horrible things I've said about and thought about Joe Biden this last week, I agree with him, and I think it's good that he's announcing the CDC booster clearance. Originally, it was just for people who were immunocompromised. Or had other health issues, and now it's going to be for everybody after 8 months.
Yeah.
So, I think that's good. People get vaccinated and take it from there. But I guess my question is, do the mask mandates, how does that really move the needle in terms of these other folks who won't get vaccinated and probably won't wear masks, at least in most circumstances?
Well, yeah, and that's why I think that.
Right. I mean, I guess say we have a mask mandate in school. But does that really move the needle on people who aren't in school and don't have school kids who are getting it? Now you can say, well, maybe, somehow, because it's going to reduce the rate of infection in the community generally. But I don't think anybody has actual numbers on that, right? It's just sort of, we know this helps.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think you can.
There'd be no way to get those numbers. No. And
yeah,
you know, it seems to me there are plenty of things. I this is where you and I would differ, at least at some level, that I am more comfortable with government mandating, at least in this instance. Like, for instance, this week, I think it was this week or last week, President Biden announced that nursing home long-term care facility mandate, right, saying that if all your staffers aren't vaccinated, then you're going to lose your Medicare and Medicaid funds, which basically means that, well, they need to get vaccinated because those places can't go on without those funds.
And I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I bet.
Yeah, I have no objection to that.
That's what
if you're choosing that, yeah. If you're choosing that line of work, right, where you're dealing with people who are in frail health, I think it's completely reasonable to insist that if you want to be in that line of work, that you get vaccinated. I have a different issue. So when we get to say, look, I can't imagine, at my workplace, when there was a mask mandate, it was just, you had to wear it in the hallways and common areas. When you're in your own office, you didn't. But you mentioned before the show, the idea of you're going to be stuck with months of teaching in a mask. And I can say with some certainty, look, if I had to wear a damn mask all the time while I was working, it would be frustrating. I would be less productive. I would be less attentive. I just wouldn't work as well. I think it's completely reasonable to say, look, are my kids going to learn as well in school if everybody's wearing masks? Probably not. There was a goofy piece in the New York Times saying, masks are great for education. They help kids focus more.
I missed that. My eyes are rolling back in my head now.
Again, the next argument will be next year of we'll wear masks all the time. But I have to believe that it's educationally better to not have masks than to have masks. And I have no numbers on that or studies on that, but that just seems to be common sense.
Yeah.
So the question is, how willing am I to sacrifice part of my child's education, right? They're still in school, but are they getting the optimal education because they're wearing this goofy, frustrating mask versus my concern over someone who has had every opportunity in the world to get vaccinated, but doesn't, right? And I think there's pushbacks there where parents are saying, look, I'm vaccinated, my kids are vaccinated. We've had every opportunity to get vaccinated, and some people don't want to do it. They're ending up in the hospital. So now you're telling me I got to wear a mask, even though I've done all this stuff protect someone who just doesn't feel like doing this. And I get that there are others right out there. There's the breakthroughs. There are the vulnerables, but I think there's that calculus that goes into this as well, that people are frustrated and saying, why are you mandating this on me or my kids? Because just somebody else is making these choices.
Yeah. And that's
right.
Mean,
and that's,
right.
And again, that's going to sound as sort of the cold, libertarian sort of, but look, it's almost like, I'm trying to think of a good example, but look, smoking is terrible for you, right? There's pretty clear evidence that smoking will shorten your life and lead to all kinds of problems. But it's,
see,
I don't know.
Again,
I feel like
you're right, obviously, about the fundamental unfairness, because some people, for various, all kinds of reasons, or a significant number of people, aren't getting vaccinated. Like, for instance, long nursing home workers, I think it's just over 60%, which to me is just stunning. But it isn't fair. I don't think it's fair that I have to wear, I got a vaccine as soon as I could, so did my wife, but we're teaching in masks because too many people in our area decided not to do that. And that stinks, but that's the reality, and that's sort of an obligation. I don't like it, but that doesn't mean I'm just going to say, well, I'm not going to do it, because it's again, there's this what is in the best interest of the community, even those members of the community who are doing things that I disagree with. Well, I have to put that interest. I have no choice, right? Because I'm mandated. But even if I weren't, I would do that.
Well, and that's your choice. And I guess to me, I may be looking at this as a parent, that it's a little more frustrating when it's your kids and their education than having lost basically a year last year.
Yeah.
So that's, that's why I'm not crazy about mask mandates, or at least we need to have that. I think that people ought to have that discussion, that at what point, wearing masks, social distancing, et cetera, to facilitate, to deal with the people who aren't getting vaccinated. And I think at some point you have to say it has to stop. Well, right? Otherwise, we're just always, well, you know, there's always the government argument of like, if this can save just one life, well, we got to do it. But that's a terrible way to run a country.
Sure. And that's, we don't do that for anything for one. I mean, well, not for one life, but we have that cost balance. And that's why I brought up those numbers about percentage of people in Los Angeles who are in the hospital with breakthrough infections. Because, I mean, that's what we're talking about. How many lives, or how, you know, it's not just lives saved. It's also being in the hospital has a human cost, has an economic cost. And so we need to factor all that in. But it seems to be an evolving situation where we don't have that absolutely solid, you know, view on, well, we know how many people are in the hospital for breakthrough infections now, but what's that number going to look like? Well, it's been rising. And so you're absolutely right.
Assuming we can deal with breakthrough infections through the booster shots.
Yeah. So assuming that,
right.
Assuming,
I mean, that puts us back to the stronger, if that's the issue, that the, you know, breakthrough infections have been increasing because the antibodies are waning, we get the booster shot, and then you're back up to where we were earlier in the spring.
Yeah. Yeah, but then I would say the argument is okay, but then in the interim, then masking makes sense because it takes a long time to get a whole bunch of people vaccinated, whereas pretty much everyone in this country now has mask experience and has masks around, or at least, you know, they're available to almost everyone, I would say, who's in congregated together in public areas at this point. And so that's why you do that.
So, all right.
All right. Well, we've gone over an hour already, and we did not get to the Second Amendment Preservation Act, which I really wanted to talk with you about. I like a good nullification supremacy clause case as much as the next guy. And again, some stuff that's going on in our state, in our backyard, in Ohio, the Senate race, and how that maybe plays out in a larger sense. And that's something we didn't get to a couple weeks ago. That report on international healthcare and where the U.S. stands and what we thought about that. And I guess we will get to that on our bonus show, but that's it right for this show right now. So thanks to everyone who has listened to this point. And if you want to get that bonus show, if you're not a Patreon supporter, patreon.com/politicsguys. And as always, if you want to get in touch with us for whatever reason, mail@politicsguys.com. That's our email address. Special thanks to our executive producers, an excellent group of folks, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Ryan Beasley. We'll be back with a new show for you next week. We hope you join us.